this webinar was inspired by Jim's article in the most recent issue of the Learning Professional magazine. Number two was focused on coaching. I hope that many of you have had a chance to take a look at it. Jim's article from that magazine topped the list of Learning Forward's most popular articles in 2019. We recognize that you want to learn more from him, and we at Learning Forward always do too, so we're very happy that he could join us today.
Well, I'm very happy to be here, and I'm a longtime supporter of Learning Forward, so it's a pleasure to be a part of this conversation.
Dr. Jim Knight is director of the Kansas Coaching Project and a research associate at the University of Kansas Center for Research on Learning, as well as a senior partner of the Instructional Coaching Group. His expertise on coaching spans nearly two decades and has produced some of the most essential books, articles, and other resources on instructional coaching. Jim is a sought-after consultant and speaker, as evident from his work in most of the U.S. states and Canadian provinces and around the world. And we're really fortunate that he has shared his insights in many Learning Forward publications and conferences. So again, thanks for joining us, Jim.
My pleasure.
Before we get started, I'd like for everyone to just take a moment to tell us a little bit about who you are. If you could answer our poll here and let us know what is your primary role in education. So many people joining us from all around the world. We have participants from the U.S. and Canada and Colombia. Two more seconds. The results of our poll will pop up, so everyone will get to see who's joining you, who some of your colleagues are. Take a look at our poll results. You should see them popping up on your screen. You'll see that, not surprisingly, most of you who are joining us are coaches, but we also have other roles represented as well, district leaders, school leaders, and we're delighted to have all of you. I'm going to give a quick overview of our plan for the next hour. We're going to be having an interactive discussion with Jim. I'll begin with some questions based on his article, Students on the Margins, and then we'll be sure to leave plenty of time at the end for your questions. However, we encourage you to type questions into the chat window throughout the discussion so that we can make this as interactive as possible. We also thank those of you who submitted questions ahead of time using our Google Doc, and we will try to weave those in throughout as much as we can. Objectives, by the end of the webinar, you'll know more about why student engagement matters, what it is, how to measure it, and some coaching strategies for building it. And before we get going, I just want to note that this webinar will be recorded, and you will receive a follow-up email with the slides and any other resources that are mentioned during the webinar. As we get started, let's do one more quick poll to try to get a sense of where everyone is on the topic of engagement. So please complete this question. Have you examined student engagement as part of a coaching conversation, either as a coach or coachee? Go ahead and answer that question. Jim, maybe you could just speak a little bit about how often you see this topic come up in the schools that you work with.
Yeah, I think engagement probably comes up, I can't put a number on it, but probably as frequently as achievement, and they're not necessarily separate things. One of the questions we got ahead of time was, can you do both at the same time? And I think you could. But engagement comes up a lot, especially once people start to use video to analyze their teaching. They look at the video, and they might be struck by kind of a lack of energy in the room, lack of engagement. They might be struck by how much time is wasted, how many disruptions there are. So when people start to really look at what's happening in the classroom, engagement almost inevitably pops up as a topic.
Take a look at our polling results. We can see that the majority of people who are answering have paid attention to engagement in their coaching conversations, some of them frequently, some of them infrequently. So this will be a great conversation with a mix of perspectives and experience to get us going. First question to dive in, I want to ask you, Jim, why was this topic important to you? I know that you have done work on a lot of different topics in coaching. Why did you want to explore this topic, and why right now?
Well, you know, we've been studying engagement for a long time, and as a part of instructional coaching. And really our work has just been sort of, we try one thing and we try to refine it and we get better at it and we keep moving forward. We have kind of design research model for improvement. And initially we were about learning teaching strategies, not student focused goals. What we were finding is where we were working, the classes were some of the classes we were working with, the kids were so disengaged that no matter what we did, it didn't really work. And so we had to find some way to address that. We started by looking at a lot of different models of classroom management. Then we ended up partnering with Safe and Civil Schools, Randy Sprick, and we focused more and more on behavioral engagement. And but then that wasn't enough. We wanted to move on to other forms of engagement. So it just kind of grew out of our, as much of what we do, grew out of our needs. In terms of why now, I think I just think it's really important that we don't limit ourselves to achievement as our focus for coaching, because the main reason kids drop out is because they don't feel a sense of connection with the school. Don Deschler, who I mentioned at the very beginning, talked about observing a student all day. That student he observed all day, a kid with an IEP, had two interactions. One of them was when he bumped into somebody, and one of them was when the teacher asked him to do something. But the whole day basically was not connected with anybody in the whole school. School was, he said, for that student, really lonely. And if we don't address those kinds of issues, social, emotional issues, along with achievement, we're going to lose students. So for me, engagement, it's not just, it's not kind of a nice thing. It's an equity issue. If we want to keep kids in school, and we want kids to come and keep learning there, we have to make it a place where they belong, where they feel connected. So that's kind of how it all evolved over time.
So it's kind of a foundation for everything else that we do in coaching. So let's talk then about, what does student engagement really mean? And we had a question submitted ahead of time that I think would be really helpful to think about in this conversation. Angela asked, how can I help teachers understand that engagement is more than just fun activities?
Well, I think the first thing is, it's really important to have definitions for engagement that give you a clear understanding of what it is. And so, in reading the literature on engagement and our own experience researching what effective coaching looks like, we've come up with three definitions that are most commonly used in the literature. First thing is behavioral engagement, which means the kids look like they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. Now, you don't know what's happening inside their heads, but they look like they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. And that's helpful when the class is way off task. If you have a bunch of students who are really not behaviorally engaged, like say, fewer than 60% of the students are behaviorally engaged, that might be a starting point for coaching. But then cognitive engagement is not only are the students looking like they're engaged, but they're getting out of the experience what the teacher had intended to have them experience. Phil Schlechte calls it authentic engagement. It's kind of the same thing, but they're getting out of the activity they should get. And then the third thing is social-emotional engagement, which means they feel a sense of connection. They feel like they belong in the school. And those three things, behavioral, cognitive, social-emotional engagement, are the way we define it. And they're all quite different. They all involve different kinds of teaching practices.
We heard from our participants that they have engaged with the topic of student engagement to different levels. We're going to do another poll, and it would be great if you all could let us know, how often would you say that the students that you work with are engaged in these three ways that Jim has described? Behavioral, cognitive, and emotional. Depending on your role, you might be talking about students who are in your dedicated classroom or students who you are seeing on a regular basis as a coach. And while people are answering, Jim, maybe you could tell us a little bit about looking across those three types of engagement. Do you see any patterns that some types of engagement are more difficult for teachers and coaches to work on?
Now, I would say behavioral engagement is probably the easiest thing to work on because it's kind of cut and dried. You can identify things like time on task or the number of disruptions or instructional time, and you can measure it pretty quickly. So I think behavioral engagement is probably the easiest one to do. The other thing about behavioral engagement is you can gather reliable data. If you gather the data or I gather the data, we're just looking at what the kids are doing. We're not seeing into their heads. So we can have observations that are pretty much the same, probably within less than 5% difference. Once you move to cognitive and emotional engagement, then you have to ask the kids how they see it. You have to get the kids' insight, and because it's self-report, it's not going to be as reliable, even though it might be more valid. So I'd say those, at least in terms of gathering data, those are more challenging.
Our participants' responses to the polls, you all are telling us that on average, you're seeing most students are engaged sometimes, not necessarily frequently, and very few seeing students engaged almost all the time. So the challenges that you're describing, Jim, are obviously resonating with our audience, and there's obviously going to be lots of conversation and questions about how to continue to do more work on student engagement.
Yeah, I just add that Shane Lopez's research for the Gallup organization, where he looked at student engagement, showed that on average, and he only worked from grade 5 on up in his study, but on average, kids were engaged about 55% of the time. He was looking at something that was somewhere in between cognitive engagement and emotional engagement. He was looking at the results from the Gallup Student Success Survey. And what he found is that as the kids progress, their engagement goes down. So in elementary, they might be about 70-some percent, in middle school, about 50-some percent, and in high school, they're going to be about 41%. And that 41% doesn't include kids who dropped out. So engagement, according to his pretty rigorous assessment, would say, or his data would say, we really do need to work on engagement because a lot of kids aren't engaged.
So let's talk then about how can educators observe or assess the types of engagement that you're talking about so that they can start to head off some of these patterns of disengagement.
So for behavioral engagement, again, that's probably the easiest thing to do. You might gather data on how many kids are on task, and so you create a seating chart and have the kids fill in the seating chart and or not have the kids fill in the seating chart, but look at where the kids are, and then every 5 minutes or so, look at the students and just put down a plus or a minus depending on whether they look like they're doing what they're supposed to be doing or not. It's a really quick description of something we usually spend a few hours on. But you look to see how many kids are on task. You might also keep track of how many disruptions there are in the class. Often teachers would like to really decrease the number of disruptions, or instructional time. Sometimes as much as 30% or more of what's happening in the classroom is non-instructional time. So if you increase the number of kids who are on task, you decrease the amount of wasted time, you can have a big impact on kids learning in the schools and a big impact on behavioral engagement. The second thing is cognitive engagement, and somehow you have to understand what the kids are doing. And so we have a couple different things that we can use. One of them is, you just have the form up there, the form for assessing what kids are doing, we call experience sampling form. And so what we do is we have a little bell go off in the class, and it goes every 10 minutes, and students circle their level of engagement from a 1 to a 7. And a 1 is a near-death experience, 7 is better than chocolate is the way we put it. Or if it's in a younger class, you could use a form like the iconic one we've got here and with the emoticons. And this form has worked really well. You can interview students, but the trouble is you probably need to be gathering data every week to monitor whether or not what you're doing is working, and you can't do interviews every week. But interviews can give you a lot of valuable information too, but somehow you need the kids to be able to report. We tried exit tickets, and exit tickets are worth considering. You know, ask the kids their level of engagement on a little piece of paper before they leave class. But the trouble with the exit tickets is the kids tended to bias high and give a higher score than we could see their level of engagement. And experience sampling gave us more reliable data. Now, we found it isn't very disruptive, but I wouldn't use the experience sampling method in a class where the kids are not behaviorally engaged. If they're not already doing what they're supposed to be doing, it's probably not going to work. By the way, if people, if this is okay, well, I'm going to do it anyway, Suzanne, so I hope it's okay. But if people email us at hello@instructionalcoaching.com, we can send them all these forms so they can get a copy of all these different kind of forms we're going to be talking about for gathering data. The third thing is cognitive engagement. And again, interviews are really helpful. But another thing to consider is just exit tickets that ask kids about their level of engagement. And so we might ask kids, for example, do they feel safe in class? And we have questions related to, do they feel like they have hope? We have questions about if they feel comfortable talking in class, how happy or positive their experiences are, and all those kinds of things. So lots of different ways of assessing the different kinds of engagement. Once you move beyond, behavioral engagement, somehow you have to get feedback from the kids. One thing I'll say about gathering emotional engagement is you need to be prepared for how challenging students' lives are. Schools we've worked with, when they've asked kids to talk about their emotional state through exit tickets, just ask a simple question about how happy their week has been. You're going to be shocked at what they say. And that's probably evidence that we really need to be asking those questions, because when we see how challenging, think about how challenging adults' lives are, kids' lives are so much more challenging because they're just developing. We need to be prepared to address those things. And that's why emotional engagement is so important.
We've got a couple of great follow-up questions. First of all, can you just confirm for us the email address again?
I just sent it on the chat. So
Hello at instructionalcoaching.com,
and we'll just send you a little kit that has all these forms in it, because we figured you'd probably want the forms.
Great. So a couple of questions that are coming up in the chat window. One of them is, when you're talking about cognitive engagement and getting students to do what they're supposed to do, does that include rigor and grade level work? This questioner says, I see a lot of engagement around low level work. So what role does rigor play?
Well, I think when you're coaching, as we do it, you position the teacher as the decision maker around what the goal will be. You don't silence yourself, but you engage in partnership and you engage in an affirmative conversation. And so the goals you set need to be the ones that are most appropriate. So it could be you look at setting a challenging achievement goal. What we don't focus on, and we used to, but we don't anymore as we've done our research, is we don't focus on a particular approach to teaching or a teaching practice. We focus on a student-focused goal. So if you have challenging student-focused goals, probably the way to address it is going to be strategies related to rigor. I guess the simple thing is, I'm saying, is it depends on the teacher, it depends on the students, it depends on the situation. There's no recipe for how you do this.
There's another question too, a follow-up question that says, I also think that the cognitive engagement is critical but hard to differentiate from compliance. You talked about that a little bit when you mentioned that behavioral engagement is the easiest to see. What do you make of this question about differentiating cognitive and compliance?
Well, we study cognitive engagement because we want to differentiate it from compliance, or what Phil Schlechte calls strategic compliance. And so by having the kids fill in the experience sampling form, when the little bell goes off, if you're comfortable doing this, you're going to get a response to what's happening right then. I think also the way you set it up to say, I want you to help this be a better class. This is not an assessment of you. This is anonymous. I just want to know what's working, what's not working. Give me some feedback on how we can make this class more engaging. And, I mean, you have to watch the class. You'll see if the kids look like they're compliant or if they're more authentically engaged, even though you can't, I think, reliably gather that data. But we think right now our best way of addressing that is through either interviews, but they can only happen kind of one. You can only really do the interviews every so often. But you can do experience sampling at least once a week to see what's happening with respect to cognitive engagement.
That's great. That's very helpful. Let's move on and talk about our next question. We can come back to some more questions later about assessment and observation. But let's talk about question four. Now that we know that engagement is important, and we know what the components of it are, how do we build it? How can coaches, specifically in their work with teachers and administrators, make engagement more of a priority?
So do you mean what can teachers do to increase engagement?
What can coaches do to increase teachers' practices that are engaging and then promote student engagement?
Well, I think I wrote an article in Ed Leadership in November on autonomy, where I talked about 30 years of research on autonomy and how it's essential for goals. People are not excited by other people's goals. They're excited by goals they set for themselves. And honor autonomy is not just a nice thing. It's necessary, because without autonomy, you might get compliance, but you're not going to get a deep level of commitment from teachers. And so it starts by setting up a process where teachers can reflect on what's happening in their classroom, and they feel they're working with someone who's affirming them and not judging them. There's also a whole body of literature that says observing and giving feedback isn't nearly as powerful as having people reflect on their own perspectives on their class. So video becomes a critical thing. So I would say I don't think coaches should be making teachers do anything. I think what coaches should do is they should be helping teachers realize their goals. And when you have really high-quality coaches who are doing their job well, who have expertise but don't act like experts, who can help teachers set powerful goals that are going to help them reach more kids. Then engagement inevitably will be a priority because teachers will look at the video or look at the data and say, we have to do this. So I would say it starts with a coaching program that recognizes the teachers are not skilled laborers, but that they're professionals. They're people who should have a voice in what they do. And if we just tell them what to do, try to make them do something, they're going to inevitably resist. There's 30 years of research that makes that crystal clear. And it's kind of summarized in that little Ed Leadership article.
You've also talked about some specific teaching strategies, and we pulled this table from your article in The Learning Professional for each of the three different types of engagement. Maybe you could talk a little bit about some of those specific strategies, and then I know we also have some questions in the chat that I'll share about building engagement.
Yeah, I was getting distracted by the chat, so I had to put a little sticky note over top of it so I could look at it. There are many things you can do for behavioral engagement. There are lots of great books about it. I've written one that talks about that, but there are many other really helpful books. But in most of the literature, most of the texts I've seen are talking about improving behavioral engagement. The core is usually we have to be really clear on expectations for activities and transitions. What are kids supposed to be doing? How are they supposed to act, talk, and move? Then when we see it, we need to reinforce it. And when we don't see it, we have to fluently correct it. We want those reinforcements to be much higher than one for one. You have to let kids know they've been seen when they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. If all we do is correct students, pretty quickly kids realize, as Randy Sprick says, you know, if I do what I'm told to do, if I act the way I'm supposed to act, I'm invisible, but if I act up, I'm seen right away. So clear expectations, reinforcements, corrections, those are the things about the culture of the class, the power, the activities, but those things are the essence of it. And for cognitive engagement, I think here, and this might get to the question about rigor, but often cognitive engagement, first off, we have to be really clear on what we're teaching. What John Hattie refers to as teacher clarity. And you might get that. We would do it through developing unit questions, guiding questions. And you need to break those questions down into smaller elements. What are all the things kids need to learn? And then integrate some kind of formative assessment and feedback. So that we're measuring, are the kids actually doing the learning or not? And so this is where achievement and engagement kind of overlap, because if kids are getting really clear feedback on their progress and feedback on how to improve, and their goals are really clear and there's frequent feedback all the time, then the chances are the kids are going to be cognitively engaged. But there are other things you could do, like using thinking prompts in the class, asking effective questions. Really low-hanging fruit for increasing engagement is to move from closed-ended right or wrong questions to more open-ended opinion questions. And then giving kids a voice in their learning is going to have much bigger impact on engagement. Now, every class is different. Every student is different. So we say a coach needs to have an instructional playbook of high-yield practices to help them help teachers increase engagement. But those are some of the key things. First off, kids know what they're supposed to learn. They're getting feedback on their progress. That's all spelled out really clearly. And then the kind of questions and learning experiences, and then kids feel their voice matters. Then for social-emotional, first off, I think it's important that people understand how emotional connection works. We talk a lot about John Gottman's work and looking at how our actions build connections or inhibit connection. It's hard to summarize these things in just a couple of minutes because it's days and days of work when we work with people over the long period of time to help them develop these things. For kids to have a voice in their learning, and when teachers listen to students and demonstrate compassion towards them and build power with students rather than coercive power, sometimes one-to-one interactions with kids can move things forward. But I think first off, maybe the most important thing is to become aware of the level of emotional engagement on the part of kids. And then in partnership with a coach to start applying different kinds of strategies, whether it's looking at power, emotional connection, student voice, interactions, all those things can make a big difference. So in a nutshell, that's a very quick answer to a big, big question.
We had a question.
It's about 2 days in our, so I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
It's about 2 days in our workshop, and I think I just covered it in 5 minutes. So it's a lot of material.
yeah, this is sort of a little intro and taste of all of the different pieces right. that you offer. We'll make sure that after the fact, we send links to all of the articles and books and other resources that you've mentioned, because I know people want to dive into those a little bit more. I just want to follow up on what you were saying about, particularly around the social and emotional engagement piece. We had a question ahead of time from Eric who asked, how can we encourage teachers, and maybe I would add administrators, to move towards engaging in productive activities and away from just drilling or memorizing for the test? So you talked about the importance of becoming aware of students' social and emotional engagement. How does the context of accountability pressures and all of that work that's happening in schools push on this work, and what can we do about it?
Oh boy, I think the first thing I'd say is let's recognize that everybody in the school is there for good reasons and that it's complex work. And so we need to resist the temptation to moralistically judge teachers or administrators or coaches. We should do our best as individuals to show up as affirmers, not rolling our eyes at people, but helping them feel affirmed. Michael Fullan has a great phrase. He says, we shouldn't roll our eyes, and there are many ways we can roll our eyes that don't involve our eye. And so I think the first thing is for us as individuals to do our best to adopt an attitude of benevolence towards our colleagues, to really want what's best for them, and to recognize whoever it is a part of a system and it's challenging. I think reading this article is an important thing. I think for schools to start discussing this kind of stuff. And so having people read through some of the information on this is important. I think leaders need to recognize, I don't have evidence to say this, but my theory would be that unless teachers feel psychologically safe and hopeful and affirmed and that they belong, it's going to be hard for that to translate into the way they work with the students. Teachers who aren't engaged are going to have a hard time creating emotionally engaged environments in their school. So I think for leaders to consider, what does it take? That's the book Better. I'm not trying to sell the book, but the book Better Conversations is really about how do we create a psychologically safe environment where we have healthy relationships, where people really do connect with each other. So I think off the top of my head, so those are some of the key things. We create a culture and environment where psychological safety is the norm. And it is hard today because we don't live in an environment. Our world is not a psychologically safe place. Just go online and read about politics or what kind of computer you have or what team you cheer for in sports. And you're going to see a lot of really tough things. And so it's kind of like we need each other. It's like people huddling together in the cold. We need to huddle together and keep ourselves warm in this, you know, kind of pretty toxic environment right now.
So in many ways, the work that you're talking about is even more important than ever.
You mean right now?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. Well, I'd say these are hard times. You know, I think if you watch TV, if you watch people communicate on TV, you rarely see respectful interaction. It's like interruption is a culturally acceptable norm now. The loudest voice wins. The rudest person takes the stage, and that kind of world isn't a psychologically safe world. It's not a great world for learning if people are afraid all the time and they're kind of rude to each other all the time. So I think, you know, trying to demonstrate empathy, to understand the emotions and needs of other people, and listening to other people, being fully present in conversations, even that is really hard today because of our technology. You know, We're distracted all the time by being fully present, but we, by listening, by being present, by demonstrating empathy, by looking at emotional connection and understanding it, then we can create a different kind of, at least in this school, we can create a different kind of place.
So as you talk about some of those issues around respectful conversation and psychological safety, there are a couple of questions people have brought up that are related. Jackie asked, for example, how do you help a teacher who is struggling with behavioral engagement but refuses to acknowledge how her practices are contributing to that? And another question brought up something similar. What kinds of questions or prompts do you use with teachers when they hide engagement issues by blaming students? So some of this, these questions are both kind of about buy-in and helping teachers to acknowledge what's happening and open up these kinds of safe and productive, respectful conversations about engagement.
Right. Well, the first thing I'd say is not much is going to happen without trust. And a lot of people have written about trust, and since I've just been reading, again, Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed, he says that trust is the natural outcome when some other things are in play. He said when people feel like we believe in them, he calls that faith. And when people can tell we have their best interests at heart, he calls that love. And we approach people with humility, trust naturally follows. And so I would say if we, in coaching, if teachers feel that we really believe in them and we really want what's best for them and we approach them with humility, that trust is likely going to follow. And to have the conversations around what's happening in the classroom, whatever they might be, is not going to happen without trust. And it's also not going to happen if people feel judged by us. We don't go running to somebody who's moralistically judging us. We run to somebody who believes in us. So the person we're working with is a product of a system, and what we're seeing is the result of the system. And so the first thing I think that has to happen is there has to be this attitude of the things I discussed, benevolence, faith, and humility. And I think, honestly, the humble approach is the only appropriate approach given the complexities of the classroom. Getting one kid to do something is tough enough. Getting a whole classroom of students to do something, that's a challenging job. And so to think we can just give people a few little recipes and have it work is not being fair to the complexities of the classroom. So we talk about the partnership approach, and what we try to do is we try to create an environment where teachers genuinely can see that we're not telling them what to do, we're not their boss, we're not talking down to them. Our job is to help them realize their potential in the classroom with students. And our job is to help them set goals. And so we have a set of questions. I have a blog called Radical Learners, and these questions are all listed there. But teacher watches a video of their lesson, and then we sit down and teacher watches it, and we watch it. We found it's best to watch it separately, although we didn't start that way. And then we say things like, so on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being the best class ever and this being the worst class ever, what number would you give that class and the student? And this is a question I got from Steve Barkley a long time ago. And a teacher might say, well, I'd give it a 6. So why do you pick that number? And if they don't highlight things that are going well, then we might surface some of those things. And then we say, so what would it take to move it closer to a 10? Well, I'd see this, I'd see that, I'd see this. And then say, okay, so tell me what that would look like if it was a goal. Do you want that to be your goal for the coaching? Okay, if that's your goal, what do you want the strategies to be to hit the goal? And the teacher says, well, you're the coach, you tell me the strategies. I might say, well, if it's okay with you, I'll share some things I'm thinking, but you need to make the choice. Same thing with the goal. Teacher says, I don't know what the goal should be. I might say, but do you mind if I suggest some things that could be the goal? And if the teacher is picking something that doesn't seem powerful, that doesn't seem it's going to make a difference, then we would feel comfortable saying, you know, what I'm wondering if we could do something bigger here, if we could do more, or my concern is this. Now, you know better than me what's best for your students, but I don't know all your students the way you do, but here's what I'm thinking. And so in the whole process, we position the teacher as a partner in it, as a professional. You know, a professional is a person who uses their discretion. And if we want the schools our kids deserve, we want them to be taught by professionals. And we won't get professionals if all we do is we tell them what to do. So that's my little speech. But I would say to get to powerful goals, it starts with our relationship, and our relationship is grounded in the notion that this classroom deserves a humble response. Now, the teachers are going to want us to have powerful tools to share when they need them, but we don't share them by pushing them on the teacher. You know, you give people advice they hardly ever want. We're way more compelled to give advice than receive it. But if you let the person go through a process and they identify a goal they want, then they will be much more likely to do it. And if they don't want our goal, they should tell us anyway. So those are just some random thoughts about all that.
I think that's a great segue to talking a little bit more about your coaching impact cycle. And you mentioned this in the article, sure. And I know that this is a big focus of a lot of your work, the three-step coaching process. that you recommend?
Sure, I'd be happy to try to summarize it, and I think it is a good time for it. And, you know, we started studying coaching around the late 90s, and at first I called it learning consulting, and then in 99 we switched to instructional collaborators, and then around 2003 we switched to the term instructional coach. And at first when we started out, we didn't have a clue what we were doing. We just said, just get in there and fix it. It's kind of the deal. You're a coach, go see what you can do. We knew the power of one-to-one conversations and the power of modeling and support and those kinds of things, but we were just kind of figuring it out. There weren't any books on any of this, really. There were books about coaching, but they weren't about instructional coaching. In fact, I think the article I wrote for JSD was the first major article on instructional coaching. So over time, we started to learn. I would meet every week with our coaches. We were funded by Gear Up and worked in USD 501, Topeka, Kansas, home of Brown versus Board of Education. So it's an interesting context to work. And we would get together on Friday afternoons, and we would say, so what's working, what's not working, how can we make refinements? We sort of followed what's called the after action review. What was supposed to happen, what really happened, what accounts for the difference, what will we do differently next week? And as time progressed, the process emerged. And so when instructional coaching came out, we had a kind of a 8-stage model we followed, kind of linear, you know, and we kept working, and then we received different kinds of funding from IES and some foundations, and we worked with coaches in Beaverton, Oregon, and then in Othello, Washington. And a lot of things evolved. And so the process I'm going to describe grew out of this research we did, what we call it lean design research, where we identify something we want to work on. We set goals for what's supposed to happen. We identify a friction point. And then we repeat the cycle over and over again. We did 11 iterations of the coaching cycle until I wrote the book, The Impact Cycle. So the idea of the impact cycle, what evolved from all that research is, first off, we need to get a clear picture of current reality. It can happen in lots of ways. Video, though, is probably the easiest and the most powerful. But sometimes people don't want to watch video. So we can interview the students, or we can look at student work. Often it's a good idea to do video and the student work. Or we can observe and share data. But what we found is, and the literature would support this, is people don't have a clear picture of reality. And so if we just do an observation and share the observation, it doesn't sink in. So we need some other way of getting a clear picture of reality. That's the thing. So the second thing is, once we've got a clear picture of reality, then we want to identify a goal. Then we use the kind of questions I mentioned, pretty much coming from the literature on solution-focused coaching. We're not trying to figure out the root cause usually. We're just trying to say, what would we like to see happen? You know, one great question from solution-focused coaching is, if you woke up tomorrow and a miracle had happened and everything was the way you wanted it to be, what would be different? What would be the first thing you'd see that showed that it was different? We want to create this picture for what could happen in the classroom. And then we want to set a goal. And we have this acronym called PEERS. It's a powerful, emotionally compelling, easy, reachable goal, which is to say we can measure it, we have a strategy to help us hit it, and it's a student-focused goal. We started out by focusing on teaching strategies, but we found we really needed a student-focused goal, either an achievement goal or an engagement goal. The trouble is, with a teaching strategy is there's no real standard of excellence, but if you set a student-focused goal, it becomes an objective standard of excellence, and teachers want to make a difference in kids' lives anyway. So let's say, just to do the first part, that identified part, how it would look. Let's say I was working with a teacher, and just to make it simple, the problem is behavioral engagement. She watches the video, and she says, I just can't believe how many kids were off task, how much time was wasted, how many disruptions there were. And so the coach asks the questions after the teacher watches the video, and they just say, decide that the goal is going to be to increase time on task. And then the strategies, and the coach says, so how do you want to do it? And together they work it out that the strategy will be clear expectations, fluent corrections, positive reinforcements, those core things for behavior. And if the teacher has trouble picking the goal would, the coach would say, would you mind if I suggest some things you could do? And then if the teacher has struggles to come up with strategies or pick strategies that the coach questions their effectiveness, the coach would say, well, what about this? Or would you be open to hearing some ideas I've got? The reality is the teacher is going to do what he's going to do. And so you can say, I'm just going to tell them what to do, but that doesn't mean they'll do it. And in fact, the more your directive, probably the less likely you're going to get commitment. So then after that identify stage, the outcome is we have a goal and we have a strategy to help us hit the goal. Now we need to get the teacher ready to implement the new teaching strategy or strategies. So that usually involves really precise explanations and modeling in some way. We might go in the classroom and model. We might go watch another teacher. We might watch a video. We might co-teach. Could be other things, but probably the person has to hear about it and see it. And when we describe the strategy, we say to the teacher, look, research has been done. Here's a description of the strategy, but you know your kids better than me. Let me know if you want to model, if you want to modify it at all. Let's make sure we've tailored this. This is what Atul Gawande calls local customization. We've made it fit your situation. This is the right one for you. And if a teacher says, is it okay with you if I just butcher this practice and I don't do anything with fidelity and I do it in a way that's guaranteed not to work, we would say, well, my thinking is it would probably be better to do it this way, but it's your class, your students. You're going to do what you're going to do anyway. So if you want to try that out, we have a goal. Let's see what happens. If it doesn't hit the goal, we'll come back and make modifications. Usually right then, the teacher goes, yeah, the goal, it's probably not going to work. But they have the freedom to do it the way they want. We don't tell them what, because the truth is, they're going to do it the way they want anyway. And then, so we have at the end of this stage, we call the learn stage, we have a teacher who's ready to implement. And then he or she implements the new strategies, in this case, expectations, positive reinforcements, fluent corrections. And usually what happens is it doesn't work right away. Usually what happens is there might be some progress, but clearly adjustments need to be made. And so there's certain things we can adjust. We can adjust the strategy. How are we teaching the strategy? We can say, this is the wrong strategy. We need to do some other kind of teaching strategy. We can say, it's going to work, it just hasn't worked yet. And these expectations and reinforcements, it's going to work, but it's going to take a while till it kicks in. Or we can say, it's going to work, but our goal, I think we can have a more ambitious goal. I think our sights were too low. Or we can say, the goal we set is too ambitious, we need to adjust it. Or maybe the way we're measuring progress towards the goal could be changed. So there's a whole host of adaptations that take place until the goal is finally hit. The percentage of time on task, the teacher set is hit. And then we can do another cycle, or we can keep working on this particular set of teaching strategies, or we can take a break if the teacher is just about to teach tennis or something and they need to take a break. But that's kind of how it goes. Identify, we want to identify a strategy. We want to identify a goal based on an identification of a clear picture of reality. In learning, the teacher gets ready to implement. And in the improvement stage, the teacher makes adaptations until the goal is hit. And those goals could be engagement goals or achievement goals. And the purpose of my paper is just to say that if you have kids who are really not connecting with school or they're not engaged, you have to address that. It's almost like Maslow's hierarchy of needs is what teachers tell me is you have to address that if you want to have kids stay. So that's the impact cycle in a nutshell.
Very helpful overview. And I think we have a great question to piggyback off of that. Brian asked if you can address establishing reality in the classroom as discussed in your impact cycle in terms of cognitive and social emotional engagement. So he follows up with, how do you get a teacher to think about that before you have data from interviews, exit tickets, et cetera, particularly if teachers are fixed on the idea of simply improving classroom management? So how do you help them establish reality and begin to shift their mindset?
So it's interesting that all these questions are about how do we get teachers to do something. Of course, every situation is different. But I think the first thing we're trying to do in coaching is to help the teachers do what they think is the most important thing to do. Now, if a teacher doesn't see the thing, let's say it's a new teacher, she doesn't know what to look for, doesn't got a clear picture. One thing we do believe is you need to give the person a tool for assessing their lessons. We have a thing called Watch Your Students, Watch Yourself. It's actually in that JSD article from 2015. So when they watch, actually it might be in a different article, but so when they watch themselves, they're looking for certain things. How many kids are answering questions? How many times do I reinforce the students? What's the level of engagement? Am I using formative assessment? So there's a form for watching yourself, watching your students. And when you sit down, prior to watching the video, you go through that form with the teacher and explain all of the elements as you get there. But our research says, and 30 years of research with people like DC and Ryan would say, if we think coaching is about getting teachers to do something, it's going to be a lot harder than having coaching be all about helping teachers hit a goal that's important, a powerful goal. Now, if the teacher doesn't see things or they're headed in the wrong direction, we can say, do you mind if I share something I'm thinking? And we engage in what I call dialogical coaching. So we don't withhold our ideas, but we share them in a way that honors the thinking capacity of the teacher.
Thank you, that's very helpful. What we want to do now is give people a chance to ask some more questions. We have about 10 minutes left, and we are delighted to have a large group. We're going to try to get some real interaction going. So if you have a question that you would like to ask out loud, please click on the little hand-raising icon down near the chat bar, and we will call on you to ask your question. And if you feel more comfortable, you can just go ahead and type it into the chat like you have been doing. And my colleagues and I will also attempt to keep looking through the chat window so that we can pull out some of your questions.
Can I answer a question while you're doing that? There's one right here that says, I've made some errors and I need to backtrack to build trust. Suggestions, the person says. And I think the first thing is we're human beings, so we're gonna mess up quite a bit. And I think it's okay to realize we have to make adjustments. And you need to forgive yourself first. You know, a lot of us really question, am I doing the right thing? And so I think we have to give ourselves some grace, just treat ourselves with grace, with the same kind of grace I'm proposing for teachers. But one thing that I think is really helpful is to have one-to-one conversations with staff. So if you feel like, and there's a column coming up this week on the Radical Learners about how to reboot your coaching. So if you feel like you have gone down the wrong road, one-to-one conversations are a real powerful way. You just sort of schedule, I want to meet with you one-to-one, just talk about the year, you know, tell me about what's working, what's not working. And during the conversation, communicate that I want you to know that I'm here to support you. This is how it works. This is what I need, what I want to do. I'm not here to force myself on you. This is how it works. One other thing is I think it's helpful if this in the system, there's an expectation of improvement. Not that everybody has to work with a coach. Probably the coaches don't even have enough time for that. Everybody needs to be working on some form of improvement. And so if they choose not to work on coaching, they're probably going to work on something else, but it needs to be equally rigorous. So it can't be, you can either work with the coach or you can go to Vegas for a weekend. I mean, it has to be equally rigorous. And then maybe somebody wants to go deep into formative assessment and do a book study and really integrate it into their lessons. And that's the thing I would say about that. Once again, I'm distracted by these awesome questions. So I better turn it back to you, Suzanne, and I'll put my sticky card back up.
Sounds great. I do want to let you all know, and I will mention this again at the end, that Jim has very generously offered to do a follow-up video with my colleagues and I answering the questions that we don't get to in the next 8 minutes. So we're very excited about that. The question that came up earlier in the conversation, this actually may have even been ahead of time, someone who said that their school requires that their team, grade level teams, establish a coaching goal as a team, not as individuals. And they wanted to know your thoughts, Jim, about that approach.
I think that, you know, coaching is usually defined as a one-to-one conversation. So the first question would be, how do you define coaching? I think when you have a team, that really all are committed to the goal, that it can be a really powerful thing. But if the team aren't committed to the goal, it's going to be a challenge. There are a lot of books about this. Heidi Grant Halverson's book, it's kind of a success factors that productive people do or something like that. And he's book called Switch. Unless people care about the goal, it's probably not going to happen. And then it just becomes something I'm doing because I have to do it rather than something I want to do. And you want to get to where, as a coach, what you're really doing is you're really helping this person work on a goal that really matters to them. So when the team genuinely cares deeply, if you sit on a scale of 1 to 10, how important is this goal to you? It's an 8, 9, or 10. Then, and everybody feels that way, then I think then I think it can make a big difference. But if people are just kind of showing up and they're going through the motions, it's going to be a challenge. And you know, when you have a team, people are in different places, so sometimes it's really hard to get to that emotionally compelling goal. That's why we believe often coaching has to start one-to-one.
Great. I know there were a few other questions where Tanya and others asked questions similar, so hopefully that begins to answer some of those questions for you.
Right.
Another question we have from Andrea. As an instructional coach, I used the impact cycle with educators until the data revealed the students had achieved the set goal. Do you suggest a specific length for an impact cycle?
I don't think there's a specific length because depends on the goal, depends on the teacher. So our goal is to hit the goal. But I can tell you that our research, and now we only had, I think, 5 coaches in this study, but over the time of the study, on average, it took 5 to 6 hours of contact time to hit the goal. But some of those people hit the goals really quickly, and other people, they spent a whole semester working with the teacher. So I don't know that there's a set time. I think, like if you said, well, the coaching needs to be a 6-week cycle, well, what if you hit the goal in 4 weeks? Or what if 6 weeks comes along and you haven't hit the goal? So we would say the length of the coaching should be determined by whether or not you've hit the goal, or at least you've gotten as far towards the goals you think you can get. And that on our research at least would say that's 5 to 6 hours.
Okay, moving on. A question from Emily. How do you best coach teachers who are in survival mode as defined by Anthony Muhammad? What kinds of goals would be helpful to help them set?
I think the first thing I'd say is they need to see you as a peer who believes in them. Those things I communicated about, that you are on, it's kind of like high expectations for students. And you're not judging them, you're not blaming them. You're there to support and encourage them, but the way you turn things around is by having success. So I think what you need is you need some kind of quick win. Some kind of small thing the person can do to see that their actions actually do make a difference. So if it's behavior, for example, maybe just the first 5 minutes of class, let's just get that part of the class organized. But you want them to know that you're with them, you're a partner in the process, you believe in them, and you want them to succeed really quickly. Now, there are going to be times when a person will say, please, just give me something, just help me do this. But you have to be careful, I think, to resist what Michael Bungay Stanier refers to as the advice monster. We are really compelled to give advice, and often people don't want the advice. And so I would say it's much better if you can fight the advice monster, just written on my whiteboard over there, and you can focus on helping the person have a success by having them some kind of control. But if the person really says, no, you just tell me what to do, I would still give them choices. I would still say, well, let me suggest 3 different things and see which one. Because if you tell the person what to do, often what happens is 6 weeks later they say, hey, I tried that thing, you said it didn't work. Because they don't own it. Without a choice, you don't get the same kind of ownership.
So as our final question, at least for this live portion of the webinar, we've had several people ask questions about how do I, as a coach, increase interest in the services that I provide? How do I get teachers to invite me to their classrooms or you know, voluntarily take up my services?
So on Radical Learners, and I'm not trying to promote the blog, it just happens that there's a lot of resources there, but on the radicallearners.com blog, there's a column on how do you enroll teachers in coaching, how do you get started, and I think all the strategies that are there are helpful. One of them is to have one-to-one conversations, one of them is to meet with small groups. If you meet with small groups or large groups, you need to hand out a form to be filled in, because if you ask people to email you, you'd be lucky to get relatives, but if you ask people to fill in the form, you'd probably get 25 to 75%. You could do optional workshops at the end of it, ask people if they want to learn more about it. You can just use informal conversations as a way to enroll people in coaching. You just don't want to make every conversation be about coaching. You know, you need to let it kind of evolve. So there are many strategies in that little blog. The most important thing, though, is you need to be making a difference. And so You need to have a set of teaching practices that are going to help teachers hit the goals, what I call a playbook, but it could be something else. But you need to have a set of teaching practices that you can share with teachers to help them make work. And if you help teachers reach more kids or save them time, word will travel quickly in the school. But if you waste teachers' time, that word will travel too. So you want to make sure you're making a difference in kids' lives and therefore making a difference in teachers' lives.
That's a great note to end on. And we've come to the end of the hour. There have been so many good questions and many more that we haven't gotten to. So as I mentioned, Jim and Ariel and I will take a look through your questions. And if we have enough of them, we will make sure that Jim has a few minutes with us to make a video, and we'll send you the follow-up video with his thoughts on those questions. If you haven't already, we really encourage you to check out his article in the December issue of The Learning Professional, along with many other great articles about coaching. As I mentioned, we will be sending out the link to view this webinar again, and we'll also send out a list of resources with links. Jim and others have mentioned so many great resources that will be good for follow-up, so we'll make sure that you have those. And we're also delighted to see the conversation that's been happening in the chat window among all of you. So if you go back in and view the webinar again, you will have access to those chats. And lastly, before you go, we wanted to let you know about another upcoming webinar that may be of interest to you. On February 11th from 3 to 4 o'clock Eastern Time, we will be sponsoring a webinar to talk a little bit more about a recent report on the national prevalence and support for coaching. Learning Forward and Digital Promise recently released a report on this topic, and it has some really interesting and exciting findings. So my colleagues will be available on February 11th to tell you more about that report and to answer your questions. So thank you again for joining us. Go ahead, Jim. I'm going to give you the last word.
Oh, I just wanted to say that I included the link to our website, instructionalcoaching.com. That's the go-to spot, and there's just tons of materials that are free that people, we want people to use them, so they're there to use. Last thing I would say is that I am so hopeful about coaching, because what I think coaching is doing is it's making a difference in the lives of kids, and it's making a difference in the lives of teachers and the culture of the school, because coaching done well is a powerful, constructive, positive relationship that's increasing kids' learning and well-being. So I'm excited by what I'm seeing around the world now, people doing different things, and I'm grateful for all the people who checked in.
Hope to talk to all of you again soon. Have a great day.
Thanks.